Nikola Volikov ist Mitgründer und CEO von Cure 51, einem Health-Tech-Unternehmen, das sich eine ungewöhnliche Frage stellt. Warum überleben manche Menschen aggressive Krebsarten, obwohl alle Prognosen dagegen sprechen? In dieser Folge spricht er mit uns über die Suche nach sogenannten Exceptional Survivors, die Rolle von Daten und KI bei der Entwicklung neuer Therapien und über die Kraft von Hoffnung, Wissenschaft und globaler Zusammenarbeit. Eine Folge, die Mut macht und zeigt, wie Forschung auch ganz anders funktionieren kann.
So, welcome to the Visionaries of Healthcare podcast. I'm super excited about my guest today, who's trying to decode survival of cancer. And we've met at the VivaTech in Paris. Nikola Volikov, he's CEO and founder of Cure 51. And I'm super excited that we have some time today, Nikola.
I'm very excited too. So great memories in Paris. And when I saw you in Paris, we had a conversation and you told me I will invite you to my podcast. I said yes, and we make it. So I like it.
Yes, good. But you're still on vacation.
That's fine.
As a French person, you're on vacation in August, but still you woke up early to record this podcast with me about a very, I would say, revolutionary approach on cancer. Cancer cure that you have developed with Cure 51, and that is only possible due to technology. And let's deep dive into that. What are you doing at Cure 51?
We are doing something very simple to explain, much harder to execute. We are trying to understand why some patients are defying all odds, defying all the statistics, and survive to very aggressive cancers, whereas the chances of survival are less than 2 or 3%. So these miraculous patients, we call them the outliers. So they are outside of the statistic. Mm-hmm. And we are first trying to identify them. And as you can imagine, they are extremely rare. We are talking about 1 or 2% of the patients. And once we identify them, we are collecting all their data to analyze, and what you said in your introduction, to decode the mechanism, and the exceptional biology of these patients, trying to understand why they did survive. And once we identify first signatures, first targets, then the second challenge is to transform them into novel therapeutics, into new drugs that would be beneficiary for all the patients. So this is basically what we do. And we started with a very simple idea. Mm-hmm. Instead of looking at people who are dying, we are looking at people who are surviving. So we start from the end. We are starting from the fact that they did survive, that they fought and they won over the disease, and we are trying to understand why.
Yeah, and this is 1-2%. You don't start with all cancer patients of all types of cancer. You start with a few specific types of cancer.
We started with the three most aggressive cancers. Mm-hmm. So these are the cancers where the survival rate is the weaker once you are diagnosed at a late stage. So we are talking about the pancreatic cancer. Very aggressive cancer. Most of the time, since it's not an invasive cancer, you will not feel any symptoms till it's too late. So most of the time, the diagnosis is coming very late in a metastatic stage. And then again, the chances of survival are very, very, very low. Mm-hmm. Then we are studying as well the brain cancer, what we call the glioblastoma, and the small cell lung cancer, which is the most aggressive form of the lung cancer. So we are starting with these three ones, the three deadliest cancer, unfortunately. And the other element that can explain why we picked up those cancers is because the therapeutic landscape is roughly the same for 30 years. Okay. Pancreas is a good example. You are diagnosed, you're going to have FOLFIRINOX in first line of chemo. And this is exactly the same protocol for 30 years. And it doesn't work, unfortunately. So these are aggressive cancer, and unfortunately, the scientific community did not make a lot of progress on those three cancers. Mm-hmm. Tremendous progress have been made in, skin cancer, breast cancer, of course, and it's very good, in immunotherapy, of course. But for these specific cancers, unfortunately, we are still in a dead end. Mm-hmm.
So To me, this was very interesting meeting you, obviously, because I have not seen a project or a company using this approach that is basically the other way around, starting with the end point survival, and then yes. from there trying to understand the bits and pieces of the biology. Yeah. So what was your personal turning point that made you say, this is my mission, this is the approach I want to build a company on, and I want to dedicate my professional life mm-hmm. to it? How did that happen?
It did not happen in one night or in one day, mm-hmm. but it's I would say it's a mix of different factors. Some are rational and some are very emotional, I would say. So the rational factors is the fact that I've been working in the life science industry for almost 20 years now, mm-hmm. In startup, in big pharma, in service companies, in medical device. And I was looking for a project that could, you know, give me the opportunity to capitalize on this experience and those skills. The second thing is that I wanted something very international. I've been traveling all my professional life in more than 20 countries. Mm-hmm. I mean, I lived in more than 20 countries. So I was looking for a project with a very strong international footprint. And the last thing is that I'm convinced, but I'm not the only one, of course, that big data, AI, and tech are fantastic enablers for science and medicine. So I was looking for a project that would be at the articulation of tech, data, and science. And Cure 51 is exactly at the crossroad of these three streams. So this is the rational thing. And I was working on, in my last pharma experience, I was working a lot in oncology. So I was now, I mean, very much in contact with oncology, with doctors, physicians, hospitals. So I was very keen to learn more about oncology. And the emotional one is a bit different, a bit sad. My mother died from a small cell lung cancer mm-hmm. 2.5 years ago. My father is suffering from a blood cancer. I have a lot of friends who lost parents or close friends from cancer. And as you mentioned, I'm an old man. I'm a wise man, and I was looking for a cause that could, you know, motivate me mm-hmm. To spend energy for something which is impactful. For mankind and for me, actually, as a person. And this project was making a lot of sense to me.
Yeah.
And the last thing, of course, I would not have been able to do it by myself. Mm-hmm. So Cure 51 is really something that we built together with my partner, Simon, with my co-founder. And he gives me as well a lot of motivation, energy on a daily basis. And I'm trying to give him the same. So it's really a duet that can explain the start off of this project.
Yeah. So to me, it's super interesting because I think with all the new technology and all these new opportunities that we have, we are also, or we should feel invited to reframe questions and reframe approaches also of science, because science is, of course, biased and it's standardized, how we look at things, how we ask questions, how we research things. And I mean, most cancer research starts really with asking why people die, and you flip the question and you really look at why do some people survive, and why do you think this survivor-focused perspective hasn't been the mainstream approach?
Yeah, it's a good point. Sometimes, you know, most simple or obvious ideas for whatever reason, not taken. But it's very important, especially in science, to look at survival because, you know, most of the clinical studies, you're going to come up with assumptions or speculations, and then you're going to test all these assumptions on mice, and then you're going to test it on human bodies. You will have problem with toxicity. You will have problem with adverse effect, et cetera, et cetera. So 92% of clinical studies are failing. They don't go till the last stage. Mm-hmm. In our case, we already know the outcome. These patients did survive. So for sure, there is something. For sure. Mm-hmm. Is it one patient that can explain the survival of all others? Is it many patients? Is it biology? Is it immune system, is it something what we call an exceptional response to treatment? We don't know yet. We are looking at all the possibilities, but for sure there is something. So since the outcome is there, we are very confident in our capacity to identify what we call signature or target. So a cohesive block of proteins and pathway that can explain the survival. The challenge will be then to be able to make it actionable, so to turn that into a drug which is efficient for majority of the patients. Mm-hmm. But the idea is very simple. It's, of course, we start from the results because we know the outcome. It's not a speculation. It's not an assumption. They did survive, and they did win over the disease, even though it was in a late stage, in a metastatic stage, with very, very few chances of survival.
So you decode the survivor's biology. You use AI and big data to identify this biology. Do you also look at patient-reported outcomes? What have people done in order to get there? Is that also something you take into
account? Maybe the first thing I need to explain to your viewers is that it's a collective initiative. Mm-hmm. We co-founded the company with key hospitals over the world, including Charité in Berlin. Mm-hmm. We have a network now of more than 100 hospitals that are joining the adventure. And thanks to this network, we are able not only to identify the patients, of course, mm-hmm. but to collect their data. So to answer your question, what we are collecting is different layers of data. We are starting with all the clinical data. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have all the medical file of the patients. We will know which line of treatment he had, how many surgery, everything. Mm-hmm. There's more than 400 data points per patient. Then we're going to collect the imagery, so the MCI, the scan, the MRI, everything. Mm-hmm. And most importantly, we are importing the tissues, the tumor cells, so from all over the world. And they are stored in what we call biobanked mm-hmm. in our central lab in Paris. And then we analyze all the different layers of the genome of the patients. So what we call a multi-omic analysis. It is very granular. Mm-hmm. And yes, we are using AI because for one survivor in the database, we have what we call one control. So it's a patient from the same hospitals mm-hmm. Who had the same disease and who unfortunately died at the medium of the life expectancy. So most of the time from 6 months to 12 months. Mm-hmm. So we're going to look at the outlier, the exceptional patient, but we're going to compare as well what are the differences between one control and one outlier. And thanks to AI, we can treat a huge number of data and we can speed up the analysis, trying to identify, you know, patterns that are common to outliers and that are not appearing to the control population.
Mm-hmm. And people are, of course, willing to share their data.
Most of the time, yes. I don't think we had any refusal from any patients. What is harder is to convince hospitals to join because that will request resources on their hand. They will need to dedicate some people to identify the patient, extract the data. We will need to get the approval of their ethics committee. So it's a bit longer with hospitals, but it's normal. It's more administrative, and you need to deal with all the security of the data, etc., all the hosting. But with patients, I don't think we ever had a refusal.
Yeah, okay. So, and I assume if you say you have over 100 hospitals you're collaborating with across yes. five continents, yes. Working across all these countries means really navigating very different regulations on health data, on research. So yes. that's a tough challenge to make this global like patient data really usable for research, right?
It's a good point, yes. The good thing, I think we were lucky initially because we decided to have just one single protocol. Mm-hmm. So there's only one protocol that is valid for all the countries. The infrastructure is centralized, but then we can, of course, customize it depending on the local regulatory. But again, the hardest thing is our capacity to deal with ethic committees in each hospital. So you need to convince all the scientists of the hospital about, you know, the methodology, how strong it is. All the hospitals are incentivized So as we are the sponsor of the study, we are paying for all the expenses, of course, but 10% of the future revenues of the company are shared with the hospitals. Mm-hmm. And we are as well give them back the results of the study. So if you are Charité, you send me a cohort of, I don't know, 50 patients. Mm-hmm. I'm going to analyze all these patients and I'm going to give you back all the results. So you will have access to the data of your cohorts. So it's a strong incentive as well for hospitals. Mm-hmm. But yes, it's a challenge. You know, you start your day with Australia and you finish it with Brazil or Colombia. So, yeah, it's a challenge.
Yeah. And then, you know, uncovering all these like data patterns and really understanding that from there, the next step could be a partnership with a pharmaceutical company, developing targeted medications, targeted drugs. Or is that something you are thriving to do as Cure51, or do you just want to provide the data?
Yeah, it's a very good question. Now, our job is to have what we call a catalog or a library of targets. So it's not only that data, sorry. It's the fact that we identified and that we validated, mm-hmm. including with experimental labs. So not only in silico, but experimentally as well. We validated some targets that might be translated into new drugs. So for each disease, for each indication, we would have 5, 10, 20 targets. And then in terms of clinical development, yes, we would partner with pharma or biotech to develop the drugs. So we keep the IP and we are partnering with people who are much better than us to develop a drug. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that's already happening.
Not yet. We have first discussions, of course. That should happen at the end of 26 or early 27. Mm-hmm. So soon, but not now.
Yeah, so not then, now. I mean, then patients will be able to benefit in some years. So it will take...
This is the purpose of the company. I mean, we want to eradicate cancer. This is one of our tagline. So it's not only about, you know, discovering mechanism and decoding genome and mechanism. It's about putting on the market drugs that are efficient to fight this disease.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, initially you talked about the miraculous patient.
Yes.
It's a tongue breaker. So people who are survivors of aggressive cancers against all odds, against all... a prognosis. How did you first meet such a patient and what impact did it have on you, this encounter?
The first one I met, it was a long time ago. It was more than 3 years ago. It's an American patient. She's a 12-year survivor of PDAC cancer. She's in Florida. And I met her on Facebook because, you know, when I was starting the project, I was spending a lot of time on groups of patient association where you can find some testimonials, etc. So I was reading a lot of reviews and trying to meet some patients. So I just approached her on Facebook. She replied and we starting to establish a regular communication. And she's now a member of our patient committee. Mm-hmm. So it's one channel, what we call the direct acquisition, meeting directly patients through social network or through associations or through congresses. But it's very rare. Mm-hmm. Most of the patients and most of the survivors that we are meeting, we approach them through their hospitals and through their doctors. So if an hospital is part of the network, at some stage, we're going to ask this hospital, do you have a community of survivors or do you know some patients who are ready to advocate for the cause or who would be willing to talk to us? And then we meet them. And it's always a blessing for us. And as I was mentioning, you know, again, what we are doing is not only statistics or it's not only algorithm or it's not only AI. We are doing it to cure cancer and we are doing it to improve the daily life of patients. So we need to talk to patients on a daily basis. This is really the essence of the company. And, you know, listening to their stories give us motivation and energy to keep fighting.
Yeah, I understand that totally. So we have invited, you have invited a special guest to this podcast episode. That's Jan. Jan works in your team. Jan is also a patient. Hello, Jan.
Hello, happy to join you, sharing my story today. And yes, like you said, I'm part of the team, of Q521 team. Like Nicolas said, I'm one of those outlier patients. And I heard about Q51 from my medical team. So it was exactly what he said. So I was diagnosed pancreatic cancer. So I'm a part of this cohort, very, very aggressive cancer. And I fought the disease for 5 years. So 5 years going to hospital, doing not going to enter into the details, but just to give you a big picture, like more than 100 chemotherapies, 2 surgeries. So yeah, very hard patient journey, but very glad to now that I'm in a better shape to share that story with people and to give hope, because I mean, it is very important. Like I used to say during my journey, I like never had any message of hope. So when I first heard about the project, about Q51 project and the Rosenius study, I was so enthusiastic. As a patient side, as a patient perspective, and I said, "Oh, it's so awesome project, and it's very, it seems to be very strong, and of course I want to participate in." And then I took my phone and I said, "Okay, I want to talk to those guys who had this awesome idea." And then I joined.
Yeah, because I joined the team. Assume it must be kind of strange. You survive against all odds, you know, against of. Against every prediction that any doctor gives you, because that's, I mean, that's an option you usually don't hear with that diagnosis. You hear, okay, we can prolong your life, you can undergo all these therapies, and maybe then you can live for a couple of years instead of 6 months. But this, like, overall survival for a longer period of time without treatments, it's not an option presented to you. And I assume, you know, you must have asked yourself, why is nobody interested in, you know, what makes me different, probably.
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. I mean, it's between patients, we always talk about the mindset. And so you get to be strong when you have this kind of disease, because obviously the doctors will not give you the perspective of going to the next chapter, and they will just talk to you about like surviving, like you said, and living day to day. And especially when you are young, I was 35 when I was diagnosed, it's very hard to live day to day when you used to have project, family project, world project. And so you have to like change your mindset and be in a very fighting mode, like warrior mode, call it when you want. You have to keep going, because there's always, even if it's 1% chance, you have to take it, because I talk about my story, but Nicolas said previously, there is only like 1.8% chance to survive, but it's not zero, so you have to take it. And the fact is, going to the treatments made me from stage 4 to what is equivalent to stage 1 or 2, and then I had the chance to get a surgery to feel better. So story shows that mindset is very important.
Thank you very much for your perspective, Jan.
With pleasure.
Yeah. Super interesting. So looking at Jan, I mean, I understand you take very seriously incorporating the patient's voice into the company, also because you need patient's data and you need to build up trust. And I'm really interested, without revealing any sensitive details, what's the most surprising insight you've uncovered from all these exceptional survivors so far? Is there anything you can share?
It's very early, because you know, we're starting the data collection in May on a very aggressive mode, if I may say, an industrialized mode. So I would say after 3-4 months of collection and first analysis, we started to focus on the pancreatic cancer first. What we can see is that most of the time, the survival is explained by an exceptional response to treatment. This is what what actually Jan was explaining. This is what we have been identified so far, and the very encouraging thing is that we already uncovered two new targets that have been already validated as well on organoids, so that have been experimentally validated. It means that what we can identify through AI and through multi-omics analysis is confirmed when we analyze it experimentally. Mm-hmm. So it's very encouraging as well, because it shows that the methodology is very strong and that we can go very fast. Usually, you know, in an experimental lab, it would take from 5 to 10 years, mm-hmm. and we identify those targets in less than 3 months. Mm-hmm. So again, I don't want to celebrate too early. There's a lot of challenges still, but it's encouraging. It's encouraging. It means that I think one of our commitment is to go fast, mm-hmm. and to diminish the usual cycles of clinical trials. On average, it's from 12 to 20 years for a full clinical trials, you know, to identify the signature and then go to the market. Yes. We think we can reduce it by 3 or 4. So these first signals are very encouraging.
Mm-hmm. So if you suddenly had access to every cancer patient's data in the world, like instantly, what would be the first thing with all the learnings you have made so far with setting up that database, the partnerships, and really diving into some of the data already? What would be the first thing you would do with it?
You mean if I would start again the project or?
Yes, if you had the data immediately from every cancer patient who survived in the world.
I would do what I've been doing for now on 3 cancers only, but I will trying to understand what are the differences between a typical patient, what we call a control, mm-hmm. and a survivor. So it's really a lot of what we call bioinformatics analysis, mm-hmm. To identify commonalities and patterns that are very specific to this population. So the more data you have, the more powerful mm-hmm. your AI will be. Because again, you know, everybody is talking about AI, fine. But what is key is the data. So our golden mine is our data set. It's a unique one. It's exceptional. It has never been done before. And the fact that we can train the algorithm with this exceptional data is one of the key factors of success of the project. So I would pretty do the same, but on a larger scale. So mm-hmm. it means that you need more machine, more infrastructure, more people. So it's about scaling. And this is the next stage of the project. We're going to scale. But I think, the methodology that we put in place is the right one. Now the challenge is to be able to scale it and to expand it to other cancers.
Yeah. And I mean, we have met at VivaTech. VivaTech is it's a tech fair with 200,000 people attending in Paris. It's really huge. I was very impressed. Yes. But it's a tech fair, and there was lots of AI. There were lots of AI use cases, and not necessarily. It's not focused on medical, but your project wouldn't be possible without technology, without AI, without. Innovation on that sphere, it wouldn't be.
No, because we need three things to make this project successful. We need the data set. So for that, we need the patients and the hospitals. We need expertise. And for that, we need doctors, experts, and people with a high level of competencies. And of course, we need the technology and the infrastructure. What we can do now, and which was not possible 5 or 10 years ago, is to penetrate into a tumor cell. So what we call single cell analysis. You have now a level of resolution that is so powerful that you can enter into the cell. So by entering into the tumor cell, you can better understand what are the fundamental components of the cell. And you can understand as well the interaction between the cell and what we call the microenvironment. You know, cancer is a very difficult disease to understand because it's permanently mutates. It's about mutation. Mm-hmm. That's why if you and I, we have the same cancer, unfortunately, the disease will not evolve the same. Mm-hmm. It's very much depending on your genetics, your habits, a lot of things. So this new technology can help us to understand and anticipate the future mutation of the disease.
Yeah,
and it was not possible even 5 years ago, mm-hmm. and it was extremely expensive. So now the cost, which is good for us, but not only for us, for science in general, dramatically decreased. So this is something which is now affordable.
Mm-hmm. I mean, also this approach, looking from the survivor, you will have, you know, some targeted drugs as an endpoint of this project. That's the objective. That work for many patients, but maybe also understand this hyper-personalization that is also a trend in cancer drugs at the moment. I mean, how do you look at that? Because, you know, looking for a standard drug that would, you know, work for all patients of a specific cancer, you know, from the perspective starting at the endpoint survival, rather than looking at the specific biology and then finding like a hyper personalized targeted drug.
We do both, actually. It's a very good point. We do both. We are dealing with a database which is made of patients from 32 countries. So as you can imagine, there's a lot of heterogeneity in the population. Mm-hmm. But we are using the same protocol. The data is consolidated and categorized the same way, to make sure that we can compare the data from a patient from Pakistan with the data from a patient from Uruguay, for instance. Mm-hmm. And the same for age, the same for sex, the same for all the criteria. So we're going to try to identify the mechanism that explains most of the survivors. And then, of course, we will not be able to target 100% of the patients, of course. But then, very, you know, you can as well dose the drugs differently. You can combine it with other medications. So there's plenty of ways to customize a treatment. But we're still very confident that we will find mechanism that can be applicable and actionable for majority of the patients. You know, the head of our scientific committee, which is Fabrice André, who is the scientific chief officer of Gustave Roussy in Paris, one of our co-founding centers, is always telling us maybe one outlier can explain all. Maybe. Mm-hmm. We'll see.
So one question that I have, you know, looking at you and Cure 51 as an example of what is possible with technology when we use all the power of technology, and then, you know, make the effort to collect high quality data from everywhere, basically, is a new approach that may help answering scientific questions that could not have been answered so far. What has to change in science, in politics, in society?
I think we need to switch from an approach which is very individual, mm-hmm. To a collective one. I give you an example. I've been working in the pharma industry. When you are in the pharma industry, sometimes, you know, you mm-hmm. are trying to build up what they call consortium. So it's going to be a clinical study in which you associate some hospitals. Mm-hmm. So most of the time, it will take you 2 or 3 years to convince 3 hospitals to join. We managed to convince 100 in less than 18 months.
How did you do it?
Because we go fast. Because we are trying to navigate very rapidly into administrative headache, mm-hmm. because we are valuing our partners. For instance, we co-designed the product with them. Can you imagine? So we made some UX UI workshop with them. We asked them to test new functionalities in advance. So they are very much involved on a daily basis, not only on the scientific aspects of the project, but on the tech, on all the aspects. We are very transparent. We share everything. And there's a revenue sharing agreement as well. So I think it's very much a matter of methodology and a matter of humility. And, you know, some of the hospitals that are working with us are usually rivals. They're going to try to publish the first. They're going to fight to recruit the best PhDs, mm-hmm. etc. But in this project, we managed to convince everyone to join, basically. Even though, again, some of the hospitals are rivals, because the cause is much larger than any interest. So I think it's a good lesson that we can learn. And I would love that, you know, other projects could replicate this methodology of, you know, having something which is co-funded by hospitals. Mm-hmm. They are shareholders of the company. So they have a voice in every aspect of the project, including in terms of strategy. And the flip side of that is that the level of engagement and commitment is very high.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, super interesting approach. And I mean, I wish you all the success for this case, because I really love the idea to flip the scientific question. It makes total sense to me with all these like access to data and all these capacities that we have now. So we come to the end of our recording. So I would like to close with a question. So imagine a patient listening right now who just received a difficult diagnosis. I mean, I had cancer myself, so I know that there, after the diagnosis, that was my approach, really trying to understand everything and being ahead even of my doctors and understanding, you know, what can there be done and how far is science, you know, and what lies ahead of us. What's the message you would want to leave them with?
You know, the tagline of the company, and it's coming from a survivor, actually, it's hope is for everyone. Mm-hmm. So I think you need, if you can, you need to keep hopes. You need to trust your medical team. Don't go too much on the internet. Ask questions to experts. Ask questions to your doctors. You can read some publications, but don't try to, you know, be a substitute to your own medical team. And I think that mental health is key as well. Jan was mentioning it. You need to remain active. You need to believe in the future. And you need to be extremely transparent with your medical team. For the rest, seriously, I'm not a doctor, so I want to stay humble. And, you know, if it happens to me tomorrow, I don't know how I will react. Mm-hmm. So it's always, you know, easy to give advice to people and much harder to react yourself. But I would say keep hope. The good thing, and I think it's a message of hope for everyone, is that we are, the scientific community in general, progressing very fast. Mm-hmm. Science is making progress every day. Technology are helping us. AI is helping us. So I'm very confident. Will it take 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 100 years? I don't know. We do our best to go as quick as we can to really kill this disease.
Yeah, so I wish you all the luck in the world for that purpose. I will follow your successes and all your publications that will, you know, when you're just starting with all these hospitals generating the data. Yeah. I hope that there will be more joining because it's just 1-2% of the patient population that is relevant. So fingers crossed. And thank you, Nicola and Jan, for being a guest on Visionaries of Health.
Thank you, Inga. See you. Thank you very much. Bye.
Thank you. Thank you so much.